Houtman was taken ill last night, so he's not able to be with us today. So I appreciate Karen jumping in at the last minute here this morning and taking care of the prelude and the offertory. And I don't know if there's a postlude or not, but it doesn't matter. We're going to leave anyway. I commend all of you for what I think is an excellent job of parking without lines today. Everybody okay? with this rainy season we've had this month, this whole project has been rather stretched out, but we're supposed to get the lines on Tuesday, so I'm guaranteeing rain on Tuesday. So, well, anyway, let's go to James chapter 5 and pick up where we left off. We begin the last chapter of this great book. James chapter 5, we'll talk about the perils of prosperity. And this applies to all of us, whether we're prosperous or not. We're going to learn some lessons here. In the 1920s and 30s, nine of the richest, most prosperous men in the country included these men. One was Charles Schwab, not the Charles Schwab you're familiar with. This was a different one who happened to have the same name. This one was a steel magnate. Samuel Insull, who was president of the largest utility company at the time. Howard Hobson was president of the largest gas company. Arthur Cutten was the greatest wheat speculator. Richard Whitney was president of the New York Stock Exchange. Albert Fall was a member of the president's cabinet at that time. Jesse Livermore was known as the greatest bear on Wall Street. Ivar Kruger was head of the most powerful monopoly, several companies. Leon Fraser was president of the Bank of International Settlement, and these men also had other holdings and investments that brought them their wealth. However, for the most part, their lives did not end well. Charles Schwab died in bankruptcy, reportedly having lived on borrowed money for the 5 years before his death. Samuel Insull lost his fortune during the Great Depression and then faced charges of mail fraud, embezzlement, and violation of bankruptcy laws. He was found dead in a Paris subway with 22 cents in his pocket. Howard Hobson went insane. Arthur Cutten was indicted for tax evasion but died of a heart attack at the age of 66 before his case made it to trial. Richard Whitney fell into debt after the Depression, served 3 years in Sing Sing for embezzlement and grand larceny. Albert Fall was convicted of accepting bribes and served time in prison before being paroled for due to ill health. Jesse Livermore, Ivar Kruger, and Leon Fraser all died by suicide. So all of these men learned well the art of making a living, but none of them learned how to live. And so as we move into James chapter 5, the very first verse grabs our attention, and I'm sure grabbed the attention of his readers. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Now, I suppose, in one sense, this section probably doesn't apply directly to anyone in this room, because I don't think there are any billionaires or multimillionaires that are within our crowd. If there are, I hope you were generous when the offering plate went by. if not, we'll take the check by mail. We're probably, most of us here are pretty much middle class folks. But there certainly must have been some folks in the church that James originally wrote to who were the target of this severe admonition that he's going to give and what he's already said in verse 1. Some scathing warnings that he will be pronouncing against practices that were common in the society of his time. And so the question for me in preparing this lesson was, how do I apply this to my audience? Well, in thinking it through, I presume that within the church that first received this letter, they weren't all wealthy. That there were certainly a mixture of both rich people as well as poor folks, those who will be referred to down in verse 4, and we'll come to that in a moment, the underpaid or unpaid laborers, and a lot of folks in between. And so we're going to discover that there are lessons here for all of us, as we see what James says about the wealthy. So we're going to focus on those warnings that he gives to those particular folks, but also we're going to focus on the other end of the prosperity spectrum and see what lessons we can learn about this whole issue of wealth and prosperity from a proper perspective. But first, before we dive into the text, I want to just give you a list of people. Four types of people and their relationship with wealth. Now, I've actually borrowed this point from Chuck Swindoll, so I want to give him the credit for it. In case it's wrong, too, I can blame him. But there are four types of people in relationship to their wealth. The first are what he calls the poor without and within. To be poor without means they possess little by way of this world's goods. They have very little, if any, money. The millions of people who struggle for survival every day would fit into this group. They're poor without. But to be poor within means that they are unbelievers, people who have not accepted God's priceless gift of his Son, Jesus Christ, and the salvation that he gives. They have nothing spiritually. They're poor financially, they're poor spiritually. So that's the first group, poor without and poor within. The second group are those who are rich without and rich within. That means they are individuals like Joseph and Abraham in the Old Testament, who were wealthy individuals, rich economically, but also rich spiritually. Humble men, godly men, who knew that God had blessed them, and they handled it properly. So they're rich without and rich within. The third group, are those who are poor without, but rich within. These are individuals who, again, have very little by way of money or possessions. But they do have abundant life in Christ. Most of us would consider ourselves in this category. We're not millionaires. We're not considered wealthy by typical standards. But we do have the riches and glory that come by Christ Jesus. We have the new birth. However, we do need to be careful here. We need to be careful that we're not measuring what poor means by the standard of our neighbor's lifestyle or possessions. In other words, are we saying we are poor because we only have two cars and our neighbor has three cars and a big boat? We only have a little ranch home while our neighbor has a big three-story brick home. So we're poor on those standards? That's the wrong way to look at it. It's all relative. Because no matter how little we may have, there are folks who have a whole lot less than we do. We're considered rich when they look at us. But anyway, the fourth group are those who are rich without but poor within. They enjoy all of the luxuries of financial prosperity, but they are spiritually bankrupt. They're without Christ. And for the most part, in considering the folks that James is addressing, these are folks who had little or no compassion at all for the poor. So in the context in which James writes, these folks would be considered plutocrats. Now, that's not a mutant form of a democrat. A plutocrat, well, let me put it this way. A plutocracy is a society that is run by the rich and powerful. And that's the way it was in James' day. The wealthy ran everything. This is the group that James specifically addresses here when he pronounces these indictments on them. So let's consider then next the reason for the harsh rebuke that James gives. The reason for the harsh rebuke. Now this is covered in verses 2 through 6. So to discover what they were guilty of that required such harsh chastising, I'll give you four things here just to categorize them. For one thing, we could say they were guilty of hoarding their wealth. Now, verse 2, James goes on to say, your riches have rotted, your garments have become moth-eaten, your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Now, I had to read all of verse 2 and 3 to get to that last line that I'm focusing on. You stored up your treasure, which literally means they hoarded it. He's not saying there's anything wrong with saving money, which we should do. Nothing wrong, really, with acquiring wealth if it's done honestly and through hard work. But it is wrong to store up money or hoard wealth when you owe money to other people. Or you're refusing to help the poor who need help. These folks that James is writing to didn't have a charitable bone in their body. Their only concern was their own power and influence and increasing their wealth even more. So they were hoarding their wealth while others were starving. Secondly, they were guilty of cheating others. Verse 4, behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, that is, the Lord of hosts. So what they were actually guilty of was holding back wages from their employees, not paying the individuals who went out and harvested the grain in their fields. Why didn't they pay them? I don't know. They were just stingy, I guess. But the law of God gave explicit commands pertaining to paying those wages. These were laws given by God to protect the common laboring man from an oppressive employer. Now, there are several statements of this kind made throughout the law of God, Deuteronomy and Leviticus. I'll just read one of them from Deuteronomy chapter 24 at verse 14. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your own countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land, in your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he will not cry against you to the Lord and it becomes sin in you. That's pretty clear. Don't hold back the wages. Your laborer lives from paycheck to paycheck, from day to day. Pay him at the end of the day so he's got the money to put the food on the table for his family. Don't starve him out. But these guys were guilty of withholding that. Now remember, James is writing a letter here to the church, to believers. Which tells me then that there must have been individuals like this within the church, professing to be followers of Christ, but were behaving this way. Can Christian employers be that way? Unfortunately, they can. So they were cheating others on what they had coming. Third, they were living a totally selfish lifestyle. Verse 5, you have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. They were living a life of unrestrained gratification. Now, let me just say that there's a big difference between enjoying what God has given you and living extravagantly on what we have withheld from Him or from others. I'm going to be going to 1 Timothy chapter 6 in a few moments, but I want to borrow one of those verses right now. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. In the midst of a series of instructions that Paul gives to Timothy that he's to communicate to the church, and this was to a whole array of people, from rich to poor, young and old, men and women, he does give some instruction here for those who are rich. So in verse 17 of 1 Timothy 6, he says, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. So whether we have a lot or we have a little, if we understand that God gives us all good things to enjoy, it's okay. Every good and perfect gift comes from above, the Father of lights, in whom there is no variance or shadow of turning. So if you have been blessed with a good job and a great income, that's wonderful. Thank God for that. He's given that to you, and honor Him with that. But to those others who were miserly, tight-fisted, selfish, who apparently didn't recognize their wealth as a gift of God and didn't use it appropriately, this stern rebuke is directed toward them. And finally, there are those who were taking advantage of the poor. Verse 6, you have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. Now understand, in the context of the day, with the influence of their bribes and the power that these plutocrats in James' day had, they were able to control the lawyers, control the judges, control the courts, all to their own advantage, so that the poor guy had no recourse, no means of resisting at all. The plutocrats ran the show. There was a comic strip once that showed a character who asked the other character, what's the golden rule? And the other character said, whoever has the gold makes the rules. That's the way it was in James' day when he wrote this letter. Influence because of money. Someone has said that is true when they say that money talks. Mine only says goodbye. And I think we can all relate to that, can't we? Now, when it says that you have put to death, or another translation would say you have murdered the righteous man, I don't know if we need to take that literally. It could very well have been. It would cause the death of someone. But it certainly means that they have put to death or murdered in the sense of ruining the lives of those poor individuals. When it was the rich man who was guilty, but he paid his way, and he got off and ruined the life of the innocent poor man. So what's the retribution then that's faced by these rich and proud individuals? Well, James says in verses 1 through the first part of verse 3 is that they're going to suffer misery and loss. The dividends of hoarding wealth and selfish living eventually turn to bitterness and cynicism, disappointment and emptiness, to name just a few. And if you were to study the wealthy, the miserly, you'd see the miserable face of Ebenezer Scrooge or old Mr. Potter in the movie It's a Wonderful Life. And James gives a stern reminder here that riches will vanish. The grain that they have stored up will rot. Metal will rust. Garments become moth-eaten. Nothing in this present world of material substance will last forever. The seeds of decay and death are visible in all of creation. Misery and loss will eventually come. Now, what if it doesn't happen in their lifetime? What if they live rich and extravagantly and die rich and extravagantly? Well, the other thing that we're reminded of here is there's no relief in eternity. James not only saw present judgment, which would be in the form of their wealth decaying and their character eroding and the misery and emptiness and cynicism and disappointment that could come in this life, which does happen to many, such as the first nine men that I read about at the introduction. But he also saw future judgment, where men will be judged before God. Jesus Christ will be the judge. And his judgment is righteous. And riches will provide no relief in eternity. Solomon, one of the wealthiest men who ever lived, wrote in Proverbs 11, verse 4, "Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death." After we die, God will never ask to look at the balance in our bank account. The only balance that will matter then will be whether the righteousness of Jesus Christ has been credited to our account through our faith in Him. And those whose account shows a negative balance of His righteousness, Jesus said in John 3, verse 36, they will be turned away into the wrath of God, which is eternal. And so, lack of judgment today, in this life, as we look around at those who make themselves rich even by illegal means and don't get caught, lack of judgment today does not mean lack of judgment tomorrow. Jesus Christ pictured this in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. The greedy rich man had come to the end, and his punishment was final. There's no reversing it. Now, one other thing pertaining to the retribution here is that injustice is not overlooked by God. As James says, the last half of verse 4, the outcry of those who did the harvesting and weren't paid has reached the ears of the Lord. He heard their cry. And as we read back in Deuteronomy 24, those who did oppress and didn't pay those wages, those folks who were poor and deprived, cried out to the Lord, and it becomes a sin to these wealthy men who withheld it. God will deal with it. He meets out His justice. And so it may appear at the present time that the unbelieving, rich, and powerful don't have to answer to anyone. They get away with everything. But let's not forget in Revelation 20, verses 11 through 17, we're told about the great white throne judgment in which all of the unsaved will stand before God as their judge and answer for their selfish ways. And those who have been like these individuals James is rebuking will shriek in anguish as they are judged according to the deeds that are written in God's book. Always remember that. Now, we want to kind of bring this to a head by just looking at a couple of lessons for all of us. There's been a lot of rebuke here against those who are rich, but there are some practical lessons that even the poor and the middle class have to understand. First of all, understand that God's concern is not with the amount of our wealth, but with our attitude toward it. That's what God looks at. He doesn't look at our bank account. He looks at our heart. And so as I take you back to 1 Timothy chapter 6, as I said, this is a passage where Paul gives Timothy instructions on the lessons he's to teach to the people in his church, all variety of people, all different stages of life, all levels of economics. So if you take it at verse 6, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich, now hold, pause right there. He doesn't say, but those who are rich. He says, those who want to get rich, which could be the poorest of the poor, wants to have the wealth. This is the warning for that person. To those who want to get rich, fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money, whether you have it or not, the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing for it, though they don't have it, they long for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Now, there are two contrasting attitudes here. One is contentment. The other is craving. One is being contented with what you have, whether it's a lot or a little. The other is having little but yearning to have more, craving what you don't have. And that's where this instruction from Paul through Timothy gives us all a bit of a caution. You can see then that being poor doesn't automatically make you godly. The selfish desire to be rich is what can lead to the sin of coveting what others have. It leads to a spirit of discontentment. It leads to foolish decisions that prove to be harmful. Just consider all the folks who have won big bucks in lottery and some of their stories and how it ruined their lives, literally. Be careful. Secondly, God's counsel is not against people who are wealthy, but against wrong priorities of the wealthy. Wrong priorities. So, as I pick it up down at verse 17, the verse I already read, now he turns away from those who are poor and want to be rich. He turns now to those who are rich and says, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited, or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. So it's possible to be rich in this world, but poor in the next. And it's possible to be poor in this world, but rich in the next. It all depends on where our heart is. There's a preacher who was known for his long sermons. Not me, but another guy. He was asked to deliver the charity sermon at a banquet that was held annually to raise money for the poor, other charities. It was suggested to him by those who were in charge that if he preached too long, people might not give as much. So if he could just dial it back a little, keep it simple. So when he stood at the podium, he opened his Bible and he read this verse from Proverbs 19, verse 17. One who is gracious to a poor man lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his good deed. Then he closed his Bible and he said, if you like the terms, then put down your money. And he sat down. That was his sermon. Those are pretty good terms, I think. Lend to the Lord by being gracious to the poor, and God will repay the good deed. Now, this isn't prosperity theology. We don't preach that here, where if you give, God will bless you. If you want a new car, then you give to the building program, and God is going to bless you with that new car. No, that's not what the Bible teaches. However, God chooses to repay unselfish generosity is up to him. May be rich in spiritual blessings. May bless our family with good health and godly children. Who knows? Might not be till we get to heaven. But we don't do it for the reward. We do it out of our love for the Lord. So does money bring happiness? Yeah, it actually does. In the short term. But it doesn't last forever. And neither does anything money can buy. And James made that pretty clear. Only that which is used according to God's principles will reap eternal reward. Or as Warren Wiersbe put it, what we keep, we lose. What we give to God, we keep. And he adds interest to it. Very well said. Let's pray.